for this. Your child is crying all the time. Clearly something is wrong. The doctor prescribes a drug. He's not the only doctor who thinks it's a good idea. You give the drug to the child. The child stops crying. It was a different time. There I was on the knee of my stressed mother, screaming over her 21-year-old shoulder as some dinosaur in a white coat, barely looking up from his wide oak desk, tutted under his bad breath at parents these days, and wrote a script for a major addictive barbiturate. I was noisy and needy, and it was answered with a pill. That sounds like my fucking 20s. I'm told I took phenobarbital during the second month of my life, between the ages of 30 and 60 days. This is an important time in a baby's development, especially when it comes to sleeping. 50 years later, I still don't sleep well. Once the barbiturate was on board, I would just conk out. Apparently, I'd be crying, and the drug would hit, and I'd be knocked out, and this would cause my father to erupt in laughter. He wasn't being cruel. Stone babies are funny. There are baby pictures of me where you can tell I'm completely fucking zonked, nodding like an addict at the age of 7 weeks, which is oddly appropriate for a kid born the day after Woodstock ended, I guess. I was being needy. I was not the cute, smiling baby everyone was hoping for. I'll just take this and shut the fuck up. Ironically, barbiturates and I have had a very strange relationship over the years. People would be surprised to know that I have mostly been sober since 2001, save for about 60 or 70 little mishaps over the years. When these mishaps occur, if you want to be sober, which I always did, you'd be given drugs to help you along. What drug, may you ask? You guessed it. Phenobarbital. Barbiturates calm you down as you try to get whatever other shit is in your body out. And hey, I started taking one at 30 days old, so as an adult, I just picked up where I'd left off. When I'm out of detox, I'm very needy and uncomfortable. I'm sorry to say I'm the worst patient in the world. Detox is hell. Detox is lying in bed, watching the seconds go by, knowing you are nowhere near feeling okay. When I'm detoxing, I feel like I'm dying. I feel like it will never end. My insides feel like they're trying to crawl out of my body. I'm shaking and sweating. I'm like that baby who wasn't given a pill to make things better. I have chosen to be high for 4 hours, knowing I will then be in that hell for 7 days. I told you this part of me is crazy, right? Sometimes I have to be locked away for months at a time to break the cycle. When I'm detoxing, okay is a distant memory, or something reserved for a Hallmark card. I'm begging like a child for any kind of medication that will help ease the symptoms. A grown man who's probably looking great on the cover of People magazine at the very same time, begging for relief. I would give up everything, every car, every house, all the money, just to make it stop. And when detox is finally over, you are bathed in relief, swearing up and down that you will never put yourself through that again. Until there you are, 3 weeks later, in the exact same position. It's crazy. I am crazy. And, like a baby, I didn't want to do the inner work for so long because if a pill fixed it, well, that's easier, and that's what I was taught. At around my 9th month, my parents decided they had had enough of each other, stashed me in a car seat in Williamstown, and the three of us drove to the Canadian border, 5.5 hours. I can just imagine the silence of that car ride. I didn't speak, of course. And the two former lovebirds in the front seat had had enough of speaking to each other. And yet that silence must have been deafening. Some major shit was going down. There, with the distant thrum of Niagara Falls as background, my maternal grandfather, the military-like Warren Langford, was waiting for us, pacing up and down, stamping his feet to keep warm, or in frustration, or both. He would have been waving at us as we pulled up as though we were about to embark upon some kind of fun holiday. I would have been excited to see him, and then I'm told my father took me out of the car seat, handed me into my grandfather's arms, and with that, he quietly abandoned me and my mother. Then, Mom finally got out of the car, too, and me and my mom and my grandfather stood listening to the waters hurtle over the falls and roar into the Niagara Gorge and watched as my father sped away forever. Seems we weren't going to live together in a crooked little house after all. I imagine back then I was told that my dad would be back soon. "Don't worry," my mother probably said. "He's just going to work, Matzo. He'll be back." "Come on, little chum," Grandpa would have said. "Let's go find Nanny. She's made your favorite pischetti for dinner." Every parent goes off to work, and they always come back. That's just the normal way of things. Not to worry. Nothing that would bring on a colic attack or addiction or a lifetime of feeling abandoned, or that I'm not enough, or a continual lack of comfort, or a desperate need for love, or that I didn't matter. My father sped away to God knows where. He didn't come back from work that first day, nor the second. I was hoping he'd be home after 3 days, and then maybe a week, then maybe a month, but after about 6 weeks, I stopped hoping. I was too young to understand where California was or what it meant to go follow his dreams and being an actor. What the fuck is an actor? And where the fuck is my dad? My dad, who later in life became a wonderful father, was leaving his baby alone with a 21-year-old woman who he knew was way too young to parent a child of her own. My mother is wonderful and emotional, and she was just too young. She, like me, had been abandoned too. Right there in the parking lot of the border crossing between the United States and Canada. My mother had gotten pregnant with me when she was 20 years old, and by the time she was 21 and a new mother, she was single. If I'd had a baby at 21, I would have tried to drink it. She did her best, and that says a lot about her. But still, she simply wasn't ready for the responsibility. And I wasn't ready to deal with anything, being just born and all. Mom and I were abandoned, in fact, before we'd even gotten to know each other. With Dad gone, I quickly understood that I had a role to play at home. My job was to entertain, to cajole, to delight, to make others laugh, to soothe, to please, to be the fool to the entire court. Even when I lost an entire part of my body. Actually, especially then. The phenobarbital behind me, its use faded like memories of my father's face. I plowed on full pelt into toddlerdom, in which I learned how to be a caretaker. When I was in kindergarten, some dim kid slammed a door on my hand, and after the great sparkles of blood stopped arcing up like fireworks, someone thought to bandage me up and take me to the hospital. There, it was clear that I had, in fact, lost the tip of my middle finger. My mother was called and sped to the hospital. She came in sobbing, understandably, and found me standing on a gurney with a gigantic bandage on my hand. Before she could say anything, I said, "You don't need to cry. I didn't cry." There I was already, the performer, the people pleaser. Who knows, maybe I even did a little Chandler Bing startled double take just to land the line. Even at 3 years old, I'd learned I'd have to be the man of the house. I had to take care of my mother, even though my finger had just been sliced off. I guess I'd learned at 30 days old that if I cried, I'd get knocked out, so I better not cry. Or I knew I had to make sure everyone, including my mother, felt safe and okay. Or it was just a great line for a toddler to say standing on a gurney like a boss. Not that much has changed. If you give me all the Oxycontin I can stand, I feel taken care of. And when I'm taken care of, I can take care of everyone else and look outward and be in service to someone. But without medication, I feel that I would just sputter away into a sea of nothingness. This, of course, means it's pretty much impossible for me to be useful or in service in a relationship because I'm just trying to get to the next minute, next hour, next day. There's that dis-ease of fear, the licorice of inadequacy. A touch of this drug, a drop of that, I'm okay. You don't taste anything when you're jacked on something. Back in the days before 9/11, kids and curious adults on planes would sometimes be allowed up to the cockpit to have a look around. When I was about 9, I was brought up to the cockpit and was so mesmerized by the buttons and the captain and all the information that I forgot to put my hand in my pocket for the first time in 6 years. I had never showed it. I was so ashamed. But the pilot noticed and said, "Let me see your hand." Embarrassed, I showed him. Then he said, "Here, take a look." Turns out he was missing the exact same bit of his middle finger on his right hand. Here was this man captaining the whole plane and knowing what all of those buttons did and understanding all the captivating information in a cockpit. And he was missing part of his finger too. From that day forth, I'm 52 now, I've never hidden my hand. In fact, because I smoked for so many years, a lot of people noticed it, and people would ask what happened. At least I got an okay gag out of the incident with the door. For years, I complained that since losing half a finger, I could only tell people to fuck you. I may not have had a father or all 10 fingers, but what I did have was a fast mind and fast mouth, even then. Combine that with a mother who was very busy and important and who also had a fast mind and mouth. Well, there were times I was happy to lecture my mother about her lack of attention. And let's just say it didn't go that well. It's important to note here that I could never get enough attention. No matter what she did, it was never enough. And let's not forget that she was doing the work of two people while dear old dad was busy wrestling with his own demons and desires in L.A. Suzanne Perry, she kept dad's name professionally, was basically Allison Janney from the West Wing, a spinmeister. She was the press secretary for Pierre Trudeau, who was then the Canadian prime minister and a general gallivanter. The Toronto Star captioned a picture of the two of them this way. Press aide Suzanne Perry works for one of Canada's best-known men, Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau, but she is quickly becoming a celebrity herself, simply by appearing at his side. Imagine that. You're a celebrity merely by standing next to Pierre Trudeau. He was the suave, socially connected PM who had once dated Barbara Streisand, Kim Cattrall, Margot Kidder. His ambassador to D.C. once grouched that he'd invited not one, but three separate girlfriends to a dinner. So there was a lot of spinning needed for a man who was so enamored of women. My mom's job, therefore, meant that she was away at work a lot, and I was left to compete with the ongoing concerns of a major Western democracy and its charismatic swordsman leader if I wanted a little attention. I believe the phrase at the time was latchkey kid, a bland term for being left fucking alone. Accordingly, I learned to be funny. Pratfalls, quick one-liners, you know the drill, because I had to be. My mother was stressed by her stressful job and already highly emotional and abandoned. And me being funny tended to calm her down enough so that she would cook some food. Sit down at the dinner table with me and hear me out, after I heard her out, of course. But I'm not blaming her for working. Someone had to bring home the bacon. It just meant I spent a great deal of time alone. I would tell people I was a lonely child, having misheard the phrase, only child. So, I was a kid with a fast mind and an even faster mouth. But as said, she too had a fast mind and a fast mouth. I wonder where I got it from. We argued a lot, and I always had to have the last word. One time I was having an argument with her in a stairwell, and she made me feel the most rage I've ever felt in my life. I was 12 years old, and you can't hit your mother, so the rage turned inward. It's just like when I was an adult. At least I had the decency to turn into an alcoholic and an addict and not blame other people. I've always been abandoned, so much so that I used to ask my grandmother when a plane went over the house in Ottawa, "Is my mother on that plane?" Because I was always worried that she would disappear, just as my father had. She never did. My mother is beautiful. She was a star in every room she entered, and she's certainly the reason I'm funny. With Dad off in California, Mom being beautiful and smart and charismatic and the star in every room she entered, would date guys and they would date her right back. And sure enough, I'd turned every one of those men into my dad. Once again, when a plane went over a house, I'd ask my grandmother, "Is that Michael? Bill? John?" Insert name of Mom's latest beau. Flying away? I was continually losing my father. I was continually being dropped at the border. The roar of the Niagara River was forever in my ears, and not even a dose of phenobarbital could make it mute. My grandmother would coo at me, crack me open a can of Diet Coke, the faint anise and distant licorice filling my taste buds with loss. As for my real dad, he would call every Sunday, which was nice. After his stint with the Serendipity Singers, he morphed his performing skills into acting, first in New York, then in Hollywood. Though he was what they sometimes call a journeyman, he was working pretty steadily and would eventually become the Old Spice guy. I saw his face more often on TV or in magazines than I did in reality. Perhaps that's why I became an actor. What kind of man whistles the Old Spice tune? "He's my daddy," goes the voiceover from one 1986 ad as a little blonde boy with a bowl cut puts his arms around my actual father's neck. My practically perfect husband, the smiling blonde wife intones. And though it's sort of a joke, it was never very funny to me. You can count on him. He's a friend. Then, when enough time had passed that it was unseemly, I had a sign that read "Unaccompanied Minor" tied around my neck as I was taken to the airport so I could be sent to Los Angeles. Whenever I'd visit him there, I'd realize over again each time that my dad was charismatic, funny, charming, hyper-handsome. He was perfect, and even at that age, I liked things I could not have. Bottom line, though, my dad was my hero. In fact, he was my superhero. Whenever we would go for walks, I would say, "You be Superman and I'll be Batman." A smart psychologist might say we played roles instead of Dad and Matthew because our actual roles were too confusing to me, but I couldn't possibly comment on that. Back in Canada, once again, the image of his face and the smell of his apartment would fade over the months. Then, it would be my birthday once again, and my mother would do what she could to make up for the fact that my dad wasn't there. And when the too big cake appeared, covered in many dripping candles, each and every year, I'd wish for one thing. In my head, I'd whisper, "I want my parents to get back together." Maybe if my home life had been more stable, or if my dad had been around, or if he hadn't been Superman, or if I hadn't had a fast mind and mouth, or if Pierre Trudeau, I wouldn't be so damn uncomfortable all the time. I'd be happy, and Diet Coke would be delicious instead of just necessary. Without the proper medicine for my entire life, I was uncomfortable all the time and way screwed up about love. To quote the great Randy Newman, "It takes a whole lot of medicine for me to pretend that I'm somebody else." I guess I wasn't the only one. "Hi, is Suzanne there?" "Yes, can I tell my mom who's calling?" "It's Pierre." When the phone rang, Mom and I had been in the middle of the best day together. We had played games all day long. We even tried to play Monopoly, but it's hard when there's just two of you. And then, as night fell, we found Annie Hall on our little TV and laughed our asses off at Woody Allen's house under the roller coaster. I didn't get the sex and relationship jokes, But even at 8 years old, I could understand the comedy of sneezing away $2,000 worth of some kind of white powder. That is my absolute favorite childhood memory, sitting with my mom and watching that movie. But now the Prime Minister of Canada was calling, so I was about to lose my mom again. As she took the call, I heard her turn on her professional spinmeister voice, the voice of a different person, of Suzanne